The government wants to give your car a letter grade.
And you know what? F won't stand for fuel efficient.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bill Radke, and you're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, August 31st. It works on everything from taco stands at restaurants here in L.A. to your kid's report card. Now Uncle Sam wants to grade how much gas mileage a new car would get.
The deficit is one thing. How much taxpayers pay in interest is another. That's coming up. And in Chicago's Wrigleyville, few people are hitting it out of the park. Later, the Rapunzel of the NFL doesn't want anyone damaging his mane. But first,
here in Los Angeles, restaurants have letter grades displayed in the window. They're from the health department. So if there's an A up there, you can go right in, order the crispy duck, no problem. If it's a C, well, you know, you've been warned. Well, the Obama administration would like to use that model for the sale of cars. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson joins us from New York with more on this. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Bill.
So this is about fuel efficiency. What's the idea?
Well, the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Transportation are proposing that car dealers be required to put a big letter grade label on vehicles in the showroom. So all electric cars, for instance, would get A's, A pluses, or A minuses, and cars that aren't so fuel efficient would get maybe a C or a D. And below the letter would be an amount of money that the consumer would save on gas over a five-year period if they were to buy that car.
Very interesting. And what's the reaction to that idea?
Well, one industry group released a statement that's really not too critical. It says basically that cars are complicated things and giving a passing or failing grade based on just one aspect doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I spoke with Peter Wells, who co-directs the Center for Automotive Industry Research at Cardiff University in the UK. He says it's a step in the right direction, but Americans might need more of a push than this to stop driving SUVs and start driving hybrids.
It's going to require some quite deep-seated cultural changes, I suspect, beyond mere efficiency messages or indeed mere economy messages. The American consumer buys vehicles in ways which are different to across us in Europe or others in Japan or elsewhere.
And, Bill, this is not a done deal yet. The EPA and the Transportation Department will have to go through a 60-day comment period to hear from the public on this proposal, but they do hope to have these grades on cars by 2012.
And you can see what those car stickers would look like at our website, marketplace.org. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
There is a series of forums around the country explaining the government's new rules for the financial system. Analyst Julie Neiman from Smith Moore & Company was one person in attendance at the one in St. Louis yesterday, and that's where she is now to speak with us about that meeting and the economic news of the day. Hi, Julie.
Morning, Bill.
There is a series of forums explaining the government's new rules for the financial system. You were at the one in your hometown of St. Louis, and Julie, I understand your local Fed president is saying the big banks are still acting like they're too big to fail?
They are. You know, it's bottom line is it's a good start, he says, but there's a lot more needed. Freddie and Fannie, for one thing, one panelist said we don't have adequate regulations for too big to fail. We've got to do some trust busting here. Railroads, oil companies, AT&T, we've got to go with too big to fail here. But Bullard says nobody will believe too big to fail process will work until a big one actually does fail.
They'll act as if in the meantime. Well, Julie, what I want to know is obviously the economy isn't super right now, but isn't the banking crisis behind us now?
Well, the pressure is building once again, though. China fired the People's Bank of China president. $430 billion loss in treasuries. That could cause a bank crisis over there. Europe, the bank problems aren't over yet. Sovereign debt problems are rising up again. And here in the United States, 15% of our banks are still in trouble, and that's due to real estate. And we saw this morning it is still in the ditch. So this is not over.
Okay. Well, Julie Neiman at Smith Moore & Company, very interesting. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
We keep hearing about the federal budget deficit topping $1 trillion per year, yet it's turning out to be cheaper than ever for taxpayers to pay that deficit down. That's because yields, the interest that investors are paid on government bonds, are at record lows. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman now, and the yield advantage could give the Obama administration little time to continue deficit spending.
Even as the government has borrowed more to fund things like stimulus, unemployment benefits, wars, the cost of servicing the debt is down nearly 20%. That's because the Treasury is paying rock-bottom interest to investors who buy its bonds.
This is not good news.
At least not for the economy, says analyst Barry Bosworth at the Brookings Institution.
This is not some sort of approval of the administration's policy. It just tells you how bad the economic situation is, that there's nothing else for people to do with their money.
Stocks are doing lousy. Companies aren't borrowing. Everything seems risky, except U.S. treasuries, backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. But Bosworth says market sentiment could turn against soaring U.S. debt.
People could begin to doubt that you intend to repay it. And that's basically what happened in the case of Greece.
Deficit hawks want the administration to ratchet down spending now to convince investors we're not headed that way. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
A little-known provision squeezed into the financial reform bill before passage now threatens to make for a PR nightmare in the corporate world. Publicly traded companies are on the hook to release a ratio between the salaries of their chief executives and their average worker. Now, some companies are gearing up to ask the Securities and Exchange Commission to tone the law down, citing all the paperwork involved. But worker advocates say it'll show just how big the pay disparity between CEO and average worker has gotten. Francisco Guerrera is a reporter for the Financial Times. He's with us live from New York. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Thank you for your time. This isn't a surprise, this pushback from companies. Why would this rule be such a headache?
They claim, well, two things. One is they say it's too complicated to comply with, and two, it's useless. So they say it costs a lot of money to comply with a rule that says you have to give the ratio of the pay of the CEO to the pay of the average employee. So you have to calculate the pay of all the employees, and that, they say, takes a lot of time and money. Second thing it says is not going to add anything to the sum of human knowledge. They say that investors don't want to know that, and nobody else cares about the difference between the CEO and the average employee.
Does anybody care?
I think, in particular, union-backed pension funds care, right? So the labor unions want to know, you know, if the CEO is overpaid, and more importantly, if the workers are underpaid. So there is a sliver of the investor base that actually cares about this kind of ratio.
You know, I'm curious, Francisco, will this have an effect on how companies pay their CEOs? Are they going to be just like backroom deals or under-the-table stuff?
No, I think what's going to do, though, is it's going to put another spotlight on the way CEOs are paid, right? There's a lot of complaints about the way CEOs have been paying themselves for the past few years. And this adds just another layer of complication and another layer of public scrutiny to the way they're paid.
Is the the SEC, is it going to back off on this?
No, they can't really back off. It's in the law now. But the SEC is charged with writing the detailed rules for this. So what companies are lobbying for is a dilution of some of the rules and trying to make it easier on themselves in terms of how you calculate the ratio.
All right.
And how you go about doing this.
Indeed. Reporter Francisco Guerrera from the Financial Times in New York. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, August 31st. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects us here in the United States? Thousands of Pakistanis in the southern part of that country are trying to make their trek home today. It's been more than a month since monsoon rains began to fall and disastrous floods inundated large parts of that country. At least 2,000 people were killed and millions of people along the Indus River are homeless. It's a humanitarian, an environmental, and an economic calamity in Pakistan, one that'll be felt for years and years. Angelica Bartolai is senior analyst covering South Asia for The Economist magazine's intelligence unit, and she's with us from London. Hi, Angelica.
Good morning.
First, let's get an update on what's going on in Pakistan. Are the waters finally receding there?
Unfortunately, they're not. What we see is that damage is still being done. There has been more flooding in Sindh province, which is in the south of the country, just in the past couple of days. We are expecting more severe flooding in some areas in the days ahead, and this is basically because monsoon season still has a couple of weeks to run.
Now, we know, Angelica, whole villages have been swept away by floodwaters, and people have had to evacuate to higher ground. But what other economic effects are these floods having?
Well, as you said, it is sort of first and foremost a humanitarian disaster, but the economic impact is going to be absolutely enormous, not only in terms of the reconstruction that will have to be done in terms of physical infrastructure. We expect to see a severe impact on inflation. We've already revised up our inflation forecast, and inflation was already a serious problem. So now it will merely be exacerbated because of the damage to crops and the damage to infrastructure.
How has the West, and I say the West, the U.S. and Britain, seized upon this as not only an opportunity to help the Pakistani people, but to rebuild some trust between the nations? It historically hasn't been there.
True. It does sort of present Western countries with a massive opportunity. If we look, for example, at the U.S., the U.S. has been very active in this crisis. The U.S. has been the single largest bilateral donor, and its response has been very quick and comprehensive. That will definitely help perceptions of the U.S. within Pakistan, but I think the problem is really quite complex. Anti-U.S. sentiment in Pakistan is quite deep and widespread, and it comes from lots of different complex sources. One example is the U.S. Drone campaign to target insurgents, which is ongoing. So there are some positive points and some negative points, and I think that although Western flood relief efforts might help perceptions in the short term, they're actually not likely to have that much impact in the longer term because of all these other factors that come into play.
Angelika Bartoli from The Economist magazine's intelligence unit in London, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
In Washington today, the government is expected to announce new tariffs on Chinese imports. This time, the target is aluminum. The U.S. blames China for illegally aiding its aluminum industry, putting American manufacturers at a disadvantage. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
The Commerce Department says more than $500 million worth of aluminum siding, door frames, and bicycles have been illegally subsidized by the Chinese government. The U.S. says China helped its own companies with tax breaks. As a result, the U.S. could make it harder for Chinese companies to sell aluminum in the States. The decision could hurt not only Chinese firms, but also American companies that import aluminum products from China. That's a familiar story for U.S.-China Business Council's Robert Poole.
Protectionist type of tariffs don't have the intended effect of creating employment for industries where the U.S. has already moved up the value curve.
Poole's group just released a report on how the Obama administration placed tariffs on Chinese tires last year and how that backfired. The administration disagreed with the report, but according to the U.S.-China Business Council, instead of boosting American tire makers, the tariffs just meant more tires from South and Central America flooded the U.S. market. A lawyer for China's aluminum industry says there aren't any plans to appeal today's decision. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, August 31st. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. As the U.S. limps along, here comes a report today that India's economy grew almost 9% this spring. That's extremely fast. Here's the BBC's Rahul Tandon in Calcutta.
The 8.8% growth rate is evident throughout India. Walk around any city here and you'll see loads of building and construction work. Vikas Pota advises companies on how to do business in India.
If you're sitting in the West, it's astronomical, it's spectacular. But if you look at it from an Indian perspective, it's to be expected. India's been growing at this rate or thereabouts for the last 5 years. And I think they'll be disappointed that I haven't hit the 9% mark.
But with high inflation and interest rates rising, analysts expect the Indian economy to slow down. Many here are also worried about the impact a double-dip recession in the U.S. economy may have, as much of India's outsourcing revenue comes from the U.S. In Calcutta, I'm the BBC's Rahul Tandon for Marketplace.
Even if you're not a huge baseball fan, I recommend a trip to Wrigley Field. It's in a residential neighborhood of Chicago, and a lot of the apartment buildings next door have views right into the ballpark. So as a side business, you get owners of the buildings charging fans to watch the Cubbies from their rooftop. Well, this year, reports Chicago's Tony Arnold, business has been tough.
Steve Alexander's with 3639 Wrigley Rooftop. It's one of about 20 buildings overlooking Wrigley Field.
We are now standing on the seventh level. This is what we consider our stadium seating. It's the highest point in the building.
Earlier this year, Alexander was charging about $200 per fan. He says his business is directly connected to how the Cubs perform.
We would be lying if we said it does not affect it. I think it affects it more coming down the home stretch.
The Cubs are nearly 20 games out of first place in their division and have little hope of making the playoffs. So the Rooftops are just trying to bring in customers. Online, tickets are going for $150 less than they normally would. A losing season's nothing new for the Cubs, but this year's skid has run smack into the continued slump in the housing market. Alan Sanderson is a sports economist at the University of Chicago. He says the Rooftops face more risk because of the nature of their business.
They're not immune from specific housing market conditions, nor are they immune from the fortunes or misfortunes of the Chicago Cubs.
One of the buildings is even going through foreclosure, and the bad economy is also scaring off corporate events that had been the backbone of the Rooftop fan base. Sanderson says there is hope for the Rooftops, though. The new owners of the Chicago Cubs, the Ricketts family, have invested in one of the buildings. He says that shows the team has faith that the Rooftops will continue to bring in money. And it's a far cry from a few years ago, when the Cubs went so far as to put up giant windscreens to block the view of the field. That is, until the Rooftop owners agreed to give the Cubs 17% of their earnings. Steve Alexander says there's no more bad blood, and he welcomes the Cubs owners into the neighborhood.
Cubs are going to be fine, the city's going to be fine, the Rooftops will be fine. So, you know, it's just a little bump in the road, and everybody's going to make adjustments, and, you know, everybody just has to run their businesses a little closer to the vest.
Alexander says he'll take a hit for the rest of this season, but he's banking on the motto of Cubs fans, that things will be better next year. In Chicago, I'm Tony Arnold for Marketplace.
Word today that the Indian economy grew between April and June at its fastest clip in 3 years. A part of that growth is in filmmaking. Indian cinema, known as Bollywood, is one of the world's fastest growing industries. It made $2 billion last year, and analysts expect it to double in just a few years. The rising stakes have led to what could be the next new thing in Bollywood. Reporter Raymond Thibodeau has more from New Delhi.
In the opening scene from the Bollywood hit movie Dashtana, actor John Abraham jogs along a white sand beach. It's all done in slow-mo to make sure the audience doesn't miss his six-pack abs and his $2 million butt. At least, that's how much Abraham wants to insure it for.
It just sounds like a joke purely because we're talking about his butt.
Anupama Chopra is a Bollywood film critic. India's tabloids went wild after Abraham's manager announced that the actor was looking for an insurance company to cover his backside, which made him famous in India.
Given that his butt played such a pivotal role in Dastana, I suppose many people would say the butt is worth $2 million.
Chopra says Abraham's attempt to insure his asset is the latest twist in a Bollywood trend. He'd be the first major Indian film star to have a body part insured. Chopra says it's a natural outcrop of a new, more corporatized Bollywood. With more expensive films, higher profits, and higher risks, more investors and actors are looking for ways to protect themselves from things going wrong.
Suppose the film is half done and the actor dies in an accident, or suppose the set is destroyed or damaged. The cost of re-erecting the set is covered under the policy.
T.A. Ramalingam is the head underwriter at Bajaj Alliance, the first agency to insure Bollywood films. So, is there any chance he'd insure the body parts of actors?
Personally, I don't think this is of much interest to us. Film insurance does not cover one anatomy part, it covers the whole body.
Hi, sexy.
Ramalingam says it's unlikely that Abraham will find a company in India willing to insure his butt. But Abraham's much-publicized search hasn't exactly hurt his box office appeal, especially as he goes into filming for Dashtana 2. In New Delhi, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
Now, it's still unclear what the actual hazards are to Indian actors' rear ends and why they would require insurance. But in the National Football League, the NFL here at home, the body can take quite a beating.
And it's not just the rear end, by the way, that is at risk in the National Football League. You know, players insure themselves against all kinds of injuries, quarterbacks in their arms, running backs in their knees. Mm. And Pittsburgh Steelers safety Troy Polamalu has taken out insurance on his hair.
Yeah, his 3-foot-long curly black mane is a target for any other player wanting to pull him down.
Yes, and that hair is also used off the field on TV commercials like this one.
Tell us about the goal line stand.
Well, I owe my great hair to Head and Shoulders. It's for more than just dandruff.
That's not what I asked, Troy.
Isn't it?
No.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Head & Shoulders took out the million-dollar policy through Lloyd's of London, but is it protection built against tight ends or split ends?
Both, my friend. It's both.
Ah. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.